Tokyo Podcast Episode Number 44.
Hey everybody, on today's show we take an architectural tour of Japan to find out which one of these amazing urban works of art you should see when you come visit. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Joe. And on today's show, we are going to take an architectural tour of Tokyo. I didn't know this, but apparently amongst architects, Tokyo is kind of known as the bad boys of architecture. The rebels, the square pegs in a round hole. And you kind of wouldn't think about this because if you kind of look at the Tokyo skyline, I wouldn't say it's the most inspiring looking skyline out there compared to many other cities. I think mainly due to earthquake regulations, a lot of the buildings kind of end up looking the same. They're just these, gray, boring boxes. And they're also limited by how high they can build. So the skyline tends to look rather flat. However, hidden amongst all these gray boxes is apparently some really wild and crazy, unique buildings that make architects all around the world go a little bit crazy. So today I'm going to talk to Mr. Robert Day, who has an architectural firm in Australia, and he runs architectural tours here in Tokyo, actually all over Japan. So what he does is, if you're a fan of architecture, he brings you to Japan and shows you all the amazing buildings that are kind of tucked away all over the city. And he'll also show you some of the historic buildings so you can kind of compare what the historical architecture looked like compared to modern architecture. And actually, after talking to him and kind of seeing some of the buildings that he highlighted, I was really kind of surprised at how far out there a lot of this Japanese architecture really is. It really breaks away from the traditional old style that they had before to something really futuristic and really modern. So, really cool stuff. If you're into architecture, I'll be talking to him a little bit later on in the show. Before we get to Robert, I quickly wanted to mention a website that was sent to me by one of the audience members. It's called the Tokyo Mothers Group, and this is an English language support group for mothers around Tokyo. And I thought this was a really great idea because I know when you're an expat living in a new country, it can be very lonely and difficult at times. And I imagine if you're a new mom, it is extra stressful in trying to figure out all the weird and crazy things going on here in Japan. So I invited Nikki Washida from the Tokyo Mothers Group to come on the show and give us an idea about what her group offers. Hey Nikki, welcome to Tokyo Podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you tell me a little bit about the Tokyo Mothers Group? What's the history of the group and how did it get started?
Well, it started in 2006 and it was created by a girl called Allison who set it up as a way to keep in touch with other mothers that she had met through the Tokyo Pregnancy Group when she was a member of that organization. And along with two other girls, Yuki and Andrea, she set up the group and it quickly grew to just about 200 members. The website was launched in 2008 and now we have just over 1,600 regular members, mostly made up of expats, Japanese women and women that are married to Japanese men.
Wow, that's quite a large membership. I didn't realize it was so huge.
Yeah, it's become very popular. I think there's a lot of mothers in and around the Tokyo area that sort of want to get to know each other, network together, support each other. And that's the main aim of the group, is to provide that social network and support through regular meetings, events, practical advice, useful information, that kind of thing. So it's a good opportunity for us all living in sort of various different areas to get together with other mums and kids who may be the same age as our own and just sort of share and swap information, basically.
Right, right. I guess it's especially helpful for any new moms that come to Tokyo and maybe don't speak Japanese as much as they would like to get information about the city and where to find things.
Yeah, absolutely. The original name of the group was Tokyo New Mothers Group, which was basically set up for mothers who had just had children. But we then extended it to all mothers in and around the Tokyo area. And yeah, there's a lot of people that come into the group new to Tokyo. And of course, you know, even if they come on an expat package and they might get some help and support by their husband's organization, there's a lot of information that they need to know that are very specific to mothers, you know, where to shop, what the schools are like, should they go for an international preschool, if so, which one, that kind of information, just basic everyday living information that, that we can swap with each other. So it's very useful for that kind of thing. And also just, you know, this is a big city, you can be quite isolated when you first come here if you don't know people. So it's good to get to know people in your local area. And one of the things we do is have specific networks for specific areas, what we call an area contact system for Tokyo, Yokohama, Kanagawa, Saitama, and Chiba. And we also have a mentoring system where we can put somebody in contact with a particular person for more specific personalized support in their local area. So that's very popular.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? Your mentorship program, is it like a one-on-one program?
Pretty much. I more like a one on five, one on ten. It depends how many people come into your area. But basically, we ask for people to volunteer who are already members of the group, who may have been in Tokyo for a while and who just know a bit more about the local area, maybe speak a bit of the language. And when people come into the area and contact us, we can ask these mentors to support them. And just give them any information that they need, basically. It could be about how to find a local pediatrician that speaks English, or where the good maternity services are, where you can get an epidural in Tokyo is quite a popular question. things like that, local supermarkets. Obviously, since the earthquake and tsunami disaster, radiation's been a big worry for a lot of mothers. So there's a lot of questions related to what food is safe, how do we find safe food, you know, what a little bit of like Japanese geography, what areas are safe, where is Gunma Prefecture, is that okay, that kind of thing. Anything, you know, absolutely any question at all. And the mentors provide sort of more sort of personalized support in that respect.
Wow, that's fantastic. You know, I'm actually relatively new to Tokyo myself, and I mean, I could use a mentor like that.
Sure, why not?
And you also have some fundraising activities, right?
We do, yes. We have a number of sponsors of the group. We have some international preschools, a photographer, even a national airline that's sponsoring us. Wow. And we support a charity called Living Dreams, which provides children's homes in Tokyo. And we've raised money over the last 2 years to pay for Christmas presents for one of those children's homes. And we had a party with the children there the last 2 years. So it's kind of humbling and but it's a good thing to be able to support.
Wow, that's fantastic. And your group is also open, like you said, to Japanese mothers as well, right? Everything is conducted in English, I imagine, but it's open to everybody.
Yep, absolutely. The group is English speaking, but it's open to absolutely anybody. And of course, we have varying degrees of level of English ability, but anybody is welcome. But the language of use in the group is English, yes.
Oh, that's great. That's fantastic. I can hear your little one in the background, so I won't keep
yeah,
you much longer.
That.
That's okay. That's fantastic. So if people want to find out more information about the Tokyo Mothers Group, and I take it you're accepting members at all times?
Yep, we are. If you you want to join, you simply go to the website, tokyomothersgroup.com. And on the website, there's all the information you need on how to join. You just simply register under Welcome to Tokyo Mothers Group.
Great, that's fantastic. Well, thanks, Nikki. Thanks for coming on Tokyo Podcast and telling us a little bit about the Tokyo Mothers Group.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
You wouldn't know it from many of the bland square boxes that make up the Tokyo skyline, but Japan is a country that holds a great fascination for architects. Hidden gems showcase a lack of inhibition that offers architects a complete freedom of expression to create buildings that they can be considered urban works of art. My guest today is Mr. Robert Day, who is principal of Robert Day Architects and has been providing architectural tours of Japan since 2008. And he joins me today to talk about his tour and what makes Japan such a unique architectural destination. Hi, Robert. Welcome to Tokyo Podcast.
Good morning, Anthony.
Thanks for joining me today.
That's
and
right.
I thought we could kind of start off with you telling me as an architect, when you visit Japan, what do you see? What stands out for you?
Look, the architectural, the freedom of architectural expression, I think, is one thing that I find very distinctive about contemporary Japanese architecture in particular. And when I studied architecture, we did the usual architectural history, which dealt with architecture of Rome and European architecture. But we also studied a little bit about the works of Kenzo Tange and Kisho Kurokawa. And that was probably closer to, they were part of the metabolist movement of Japanese architects from the late 60s, early 70s. So they were sort of creating this innovative architecture, which probably had a little bit more architectural freedom of expression. I mean, the Yoyogi Gymnasium, the Olympic Gymnasium that Kenzo Tange did for the 64 Olympics is still a wonderful building and outstanding piece of architecture and engineering. And the Nakagin Capsule Tower was the one that that is the little boxy capsule building that down near Shimbashi that Kisho Kurokawa did. So we sort of learned a little bit about that. And from there, it's been of interest to me, but it wasn't until that I went to live in Japan that I suppose my interest really exploded, so to speak.
I'm surprised to hear when you said that in our earlier emails, you said that Japan is considered by many a premier destination for architects. I was surprised to hear that because when I look at the Tokyo skyline, it doesn't look that interesting to me. The buildings all represent kind of the same look to me. What do you see that I don't see?
That's perfectly understandable, and I think you see so much of the urban blandness, I would describe it as. There's so much of not much of interest. But so when something is a little bit more interesting, I think it tends to stand out quite a deal more. With so many architects, I suppose, competing for prominence in Japan, you really have to be doing something that's quite outstanding or extraordinary to be able to stand out from the rest of the average, so to speak.
Right.
I mean, I'm friendly with Japanese architects, and they suffer the same issues and challenges that architects face in Australia and the USA and other parts of the world with budgetary constraints and clients' briefs that perhaps don't enable architects to perhaps use or be as expressive or as innovative with their designs as they would like to be. But just so many of them in Japan seem to, or the ones that are of great interest to architects, just tend to have that that element of extraordinary and also a little bit of whimsy as well, I suppose, because that one that I find quite interesting is the Asahi Beer Hall that's over near Asakusa that French architect Philippe Starck designed. With the golden flame on top, which is possibly described as other things, but that's quite an interesting building, and a lot of people who come with me on my tours look at it and go, well, what is it? I said, well, it's a restaurant, reception lounge, and offices. Yeah, but what is it? I said, well, it's just a building, and there's a lot of things from that bubble era. The 80s bubble economy that were developed in those times, which possibly had more of a folly aspect to it than of anything of architectural usefulness, I think.
Is there a particular challenge to architects here in Japan due to the large number of earthquakes?
Absolutely. Look, the challenges that architects need to deal with in Japan, more so particularly the earthquake issues, is something that has to be dealt with. And the other one is the space factor. given the fact that that many buildings don't have a very large land area, and you're designing a building on something that might be 60, 70, 100 square meters in land area, which isn't very much bigger than, you know, a tennis court or something like that. Right, you know, it's so, you know, probably smaller than a tennis court. So, you know, one example is one we visited on the last tour where it was 100 square meters. So what's that sort of 30 yards by 30 yards or thereabouts? But it it's three stories, triangular shaped building, enough room to get the car off the street, and a family of four live in that. You know, so it's you know, I suppose you yourself would appreciate the fact that space is something that's a premium, and Japanese are very good at not wasting space, which right. Which I particularly liked, and thought that perhaps I came back to Australia after working there with that skill to perhaps make more utilize space a little bit more than I would normally do.
So do these constraints that architects face here in Japan, does that create unique architecture that's unique to Japan?
Look, I think it does in many ways, because it's a very, very small site means that you need to come up with a fairly innovative solution. And that's where I think that innovative solutions tend to create quite interesting and good results.
And does that influence architectural design in the rest of the world? Do they kind of look at Japan as kind of this unique situation? And like you said, like when you go back to Australia, you look for space-saving designs. Does that influence the rest of the world?
Look, that in many ways it does, but I think the freedom of expression that Japanese architects seem to have. Now, it's whether or not they actually do, or it just appears that they do. But again, the National Arts Centre Tokyo is a new gallery in the Roppongi area that Kisha Kurokawa did, and it's got a glass facade with a convex, concave, you know, curtain wall that moves in and out, and it's a beautiful building, and the interior is wonderful with these triangular shaped or conical shaped elements in the foyer space that are being used as restaurants and cafes. And you look at things like that, and the overwhelming response to these particular buildings is from people who'd come on my tours is, you know, wow, we'd never get to do that back home. And and I don't know, I suppose budget is in some regards has a lot to do with it. You know, the more money you have, usually the better you can, the more interesting things and nicer, more time you can spend on designing it and making everything look fantastic. But, you know, that's one example that's quite extraordinary.
Where do you think that comes from? Because it's interesting to hear you say that, because freedom of expression is not something I would overly associate with Japan. You know, conformity is something that I would, you know, associate with Japan. So to hear that these architects have this freedom to do what they want and create these amazing designs, to me, kind of surprises me to associate that with hearing that from, you know, in Japan.
That's exactly right. And I suppose that's what's sort of the paradox, I suppose, that makes Japan such an interesting place to visit, not just for architecture, but for other things as well, because, but regarding architecture, you've got, when you consider the population numbers, the number of people doing architecture, you know, the competition is fairly fierce. You know, there's a lot of people competing in the same area. So to stand out, you've really got to do something pretty dramatic. And the people who do end up doing something pretty dramatic tend to get noticed fairly quickly. And I suppose in some areas, maybe architecture, you know, some in some other disciplines, you might get dismissed as a crackpot because you've got some crazy way out idea. But perhaps in architecture, it's probably possibly more accepted.
When you look at it, when you come here, when you look at the buildings that you see, if you could use one word to describe it, what would your take on it be?
The architecture of Japan?
Yes.
Oh, one word's a bit hard, I suppose, but
I mean, like the newer buildings, because one thing I've kind of noticed is that many of the buildings here seem to have a rather futuristic design.
Yeah,
there doesn't seem to be any kind of attempt to create a retro design or kind of link the past to the future or anything like that. Everything, not everything, but I mean, many of the buildings I see seem to really push this square, cubist, futuristic design.
Look, and that's exactly it's, and I think that's the lack of reference to any vernacular, and it is probably another interesting factor with the contemporary architecture as well. I mean, there's the Mikimoto 2 building in Ginza. The Prada boutique, which is designed by Swiss architects, but again, along the strip along Motosando, you've got buildings by Tadao Ando, Toyo Ito, and they don't have any reference to anything else around them. So they sort of do tend to exist in their own space and therefore become a bit of urban sculpture in many ways than just a building.
Right.
You know, because they don't need to draw reference from other things. They, in many, in along the Omotesando strip and Ginza, I suppose you've got the international boutique brands trying to outdo each other in terms of getting the super megastar architects to design buildings for them. So, you know, some guy gets Tadao Ando to design one, well, then somebody else will go and get, Renzo Piano, the Italian architect, to design theirs, and then somebody else will get somebody else. And there's a sort of a bit of a constant or continual sort of effort to outdo each other in some ways, whether or not that's purpose, you know, that's it, my view on it, and I'm probably imagine there's a fair bit of truth to that.
So the push is always for something new and modern, flashy, to attract the attention of the shoppers.
Oh, I think there's got to be a degree of that because, you do want to stand out, you know. I mean, there's the new building that Uniqlo are in Ginza, which is a nice looking building, nothing terribly fabulous, but when I was there just a couple of months ago, it was 10 or 12 stories, but each floor had a revolving mannequin, you know, a row of revolving mannequins on each at the window front addressing the main road in Ginza there. So it became a bit more of a, you know, an interactive shop front, a bit of street theatre as well, you know. So it's all sort of, when you say to grab your attention, I mean, that's certainly a good way to do it. You know, shop fronts are one thing, but a really interesting building is another way as well.
Right. Yeah, I never really kind of thought about that. I've been to Ginza, I've been to Omotesando many times, and certainly, you know, the unique buildings do stand out. But I think there's also so many bland boxes here. I always told people that, in my opinion, the Tokyo skyline looks better at night.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's probably the case. With
lit up with the red dots and kind of gives it a futuristic noir type feeling to it. In the daytime, I always found it looked kind of dull. But you're right, is that, you know, hidden amongst that, you got to look a little bit carefully. There are some really unique buildings that you wouldn't see anywhere else.
Oh, look, and the thing is, it's one of those things that that maybe architects look at that other people don't. You know, I suppose if you could imagine yourself walking down the main street of your hometown, you know, where I am in Brisbane, you walk down the Queen Street Mall, there's all buildings either side. You could stop 10 people and ask them to describe the buildings that they've just walked past, and most of them wouldn't even be able to describe it. That's exactly right. So, It's just one of those things where people in design professions tend to pay a lot more attention to detail and what looks nice and what doesn't. Look at things with a critical eye, so that's the sort of, and we spend a lot of time looking at magazines and online journals and things like that. So, and spend a lot of time looking for inspiration. And when you see a lot of the work that's come from Japan or coming out of Japan that looks rather interesting, well, then that's what sort of piques people's interest then and go, oh, wow, that's a nice place. I wouldn't mind going there. Right. And in many ways, Japan sort of seems to do that for people. I mean, there's always the charm. You know, we also go to Kyoto as well. We spend a bit of time looking at historical buildings. So, Japan's has, I don't know, I'm not familiar with other people who might do it, but there's several open-air architectural museums. So you've got the Edo Tokyo one that's out near sort of Mitaka area. There's got the Minka Inn that's down in Kawasaki City. And probably one of the more famous ones is Meiji Mura, which is down near Nagoya. So there's been an effort to save a bit of the cultural and architectural heritage of Japan, particularly with the Meiji Mura one and the Edo Tokyo Open Air Museum, is they've disassembled buildings from a particular era, one being the Edo period and the other one being the Meiji period, and rebuilt them in these areas. So Meiji Mura, fairly major industrialization and modernization of Japan in that late, 19th century. And a lot of the buildings were being demolished in the 60s. So there was a gentleman who got together with his friend who was a wealthy industrialist, and they started this, open air architectural museum, and they've got 100 or so buildings down there, and every time we go there, the place is packed with school kids from all over Japan, and it's just extraordinary. And again, that's a major surprise for people who come with me on the tours, because it's not something that we could ever see in Australia that would make any money. People want to come and look at koalas and kangaroos here. Why would you want to go and look at some buildings that are 150 years old?
Tell me about your tour. You've been running the tour since 2008.
Yes.
And your next tour is coming up in September, is that right?
That's correct. Yep, that's correct.
What are the dates of the September tour?
27th of September to the 6th of October.
And if people wanted to book that, how do they do it?
They can contact me via there's Japan Architecture Tours. There's a Facebook page there they can contact me through, or there's a Japan Architecture Tours WordPress blog they can contact me through as well.
Okay. And on your tour, let me first ask, if someone is not an architect,
yes,
can they still go on the tour? What will they get out of it?
Absolutely. Look, I have, there was an architect from Australia who I spoke with recently. She hasn't quite decided whether or not she wants to join us, but she has a friend who she would like to take with her. I mean, we've had other non-architects on the trip before. So we've had surgeons and gynecologists and geologists and all range of people who are not architects. So generally, they've got an interest in art and the arts and design. But, I mean, the point that I made to this person recently was, if you go to Rome, for argument's sake, and I said, has she been to Rome? And she said, yes, she'd been to Rome. And I said, well, where'd she visit? She went to the Vatican, she went to the Pantheon, she went to the Spanish Steps, she went to the Colosseum, she went to the Forum. And I said, what are they? All of those places are architectural sites. And you go to countries around the world, and they generally, you learn about people's culture through their art and architectural heritage. So, you visit galleries, you go and, you go to the Colosseum, you go to the Forum, you look at the Pantheon, These sort of things, they're all architectural monuments and relics, but you've got, it's that connection with culture, and you know, and you learn about culture, the history of different cultures through their art and architecture, mostly, right. especially when there's no written record of some of it. So, I mean, when I put it to people in that way, you know, I suppose the penny drops. You know, right. The other side is too. There's a lot of people who inquire about my tours who don't want to do the regular tour, if there's such a thing, you know, that there's a hop on and off bus thing, that everybody sort of gets piled into one place and then you get piled back on a bus, and then, you know, you get to this, you end up getting dragged around to the same old tourist spots,
right,
with 50,000 other people on buses following behind people as well. Where, I mean, my tour is a little bit more organic. There's a reasonably set schedule, but we don't necessarily stick to it as rigidly as you know, many other people might. It might change on a daily basis depending on the weather, or again depends on how the group feels. You know, if somebody makes a suggestion, you know, can we do this instead of that? You know, so we'll look, okay, what's the group say? And, you know, I'll make my point as to why I think we should do something, you know, what's on the schedule. And if the group decides they want to do something else, well, then we might see if we can build that in as well. So, you know, so it's, I think, you, another, I mean, we also get, we spend time with some of my Japanese friends as well. So we spend a day with the Saitama Architects Association, so Mr. Kondo and Takeuchi and these other people that I've worked with in the past. So we spend a day with them. They talk to people about what it's like to be an architect. But we also have dinner and lunches with some friends of mine as well. So there's more of an informal nature about it too. So you get the opportunity to meet some people who are, you know, just like the average person on the street, you know. So
what's the itinerary of the tour? Do you start in Tokyo, and where do you go from there?
Start in Tokyo. So we have 6 nights in Tokyo, 4 nights in Kyoto. So we spend the first few days in Tokyo. One day we then go to Saitama. So usually go and visit some historic sites around there. Kawagoe is one of the more popular destinations we would go to on that. And then we would head down to Kyoto. Using Kyoto as the base, then we sort of do day two tours around Kyoto, looking at the big, you know, highlights there, like Kinkakuji and Kiyomizu-dera, Nijojo, and those sort of places. And then there's a Frank Lloyd Wright house that's down near Kobe, so we go and visit that. There's also the Tadao Ando's Church of Light that's down that way as well, so we visit that as well. And then one of those other days, I said, we go up to Meiji Mura for the day, which is a fairly solid day. We leave early and don't get back till quite late. But we try to structure it all so most of the stuff's over and done with, sort of by late in the afternoon, and people can go and do their own thing then, and we just meet up the next morning in the foyer and off we go again.
Interesting. I like the idea of the tour, because I think it gives people an alternative look into Japan. You know, like you said, like for most people who are not architects or perhaps are not designers, they would come to Japan, they'd walk around Tokyo, and they might miss a lot of these buildings.
Absolutely.
And they might go to Ginza and they'll look at the shoppers, they'll look at the stores, but they'll miss the small details that for you might see, for example. So I think a tour like this kind of gives another way of looking at Japan.
Absolutely, yeah. And look, that's been the popularity of them to date too. I mean, we've done 2, 4, about 8 trips now. And I've had 4 people who have come more than once. So, and whilst we don't necessarily do exactly the same thing, you know, there are some overlaps, but you know, they have a different experience each time they come. So I thought that's always quite nice when people think they want to go again. You know, they enjoyed it so much the first time. I mean, the overwhelming response has generally been that people will say at the end of the trip that it exceeded their expectations. And that's a wonderful thing, in my opinion. You know, it makes me feel good that I've offered, delivered something that is, you know, I always try to put a lot into it, right, so that you know, it clearly represents good value for money. But when people say, you know, exceeded their expectations, well, I think that's a great response.
So if people want to find out more information about your tour, they can visit your website at japanarchitecturetours.com. And your next tour is from September 27th to October 6th.
That's correct.
And all the information can be found on your website. Okay, well, that's great. Thanks, Robert. Thanks for coming on the show and giving us an insight into the architecture here in Japan.
You're welcome. Thank you very much, Anthony.
Thanks again to Robert for coming on the show. If you're interested in finding out more information about his tour, visit his website at japanarchitecturetours.com. And his next tour dates are from September 27th to October 6th. If you are a new mom here in Tokyo and you need some help getting your life established here, I definitely recommend checking out the Tokyo Mothers Group. They have a fantastic support system as well as a lot of fun activities that you and your child can participate in, and you can find them on the web at tokyomothersgroup.com. Don't forget that if you're on Facebook, you can always send me a message. I am on Facebook at facebook.com/Tokyo Podcast. And if you'd like to be featured on the show or you have a guest recommendation, send me a message on Twitter at Tokyo Podcast as well. That's it. Thanks for listening, everybody. Oh, before I go, I have a very special announcement concerning the future of Tokyo Podcast on next week's show. I'll give you a hint actually about next week's show because I'm super excited about it. How many of you have heard of the movie Jiro Dreams of Sushi? It's a documentary about a Japanese man who runs a sushi restaurant in Ginza, in the Ginza subway station. And this sushi restaurant is one of the only sushi restaurants in the world that has been awarded 3 stars by the Michelin Restaurant Review people. And anyways, this American filmmaker decided to make a documentary film about it, and it is absolutely fantastic. It's got a 99% rating, approval rating, fresh rating, whatever you call it, on Rotten Tomatoes, and it is a really great documentary. So I managed to track down the director. He's going to be calling in from California, and we're going to talk to him about making this documentary. So if you're interested in documentary film or sushi or anything about that, check out next week's show. And in the meantime, I highly recommend going and finding the documentary Jiro Dreams of Sushi and watching it, because he's great. And if you have any questions you want me to ask the director, just send it to me on Twitter at Tokyo Podcast, and I'll make sure to try to get your question on the air. So that's it. Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Anthony Joe, and talk to you next week. Bye bye.